In Florida, the space shuttle has been a jobs creator for decades now. For thousands of people, the shuttle's last mission is not just the end of an era, it's also the end of a career. Nearly 8,000 men and women who worked on the shuttle program have been laid off. Still, NPR's Greg Allen found that some people on the so-called Space Coast remain optimistic about their region's future.
For someone who's just lost his job, Kim Kennedy is remarkably upbeat.
I've really enjoyed it. It's been a great career and some of the best people in the world out there, I'll tell you. Too bad it's coming to an end.
We're at a Starbucks on Merritt Island, a bedroom community for many who work at Kennedy Space Center. After 23 years working for United Space Alliance, a prime shuttle contractor, Kennedy was laid off in April.
That's actually a picture of Endeavour. That's my wallpaper when we rolled out for the last mission.
He's brought along his laptop with pictures from some of the nearly 120 missions he worked on as a shuttle technician. He recalls his first day on the job. It was after the tragic Challenger disaster and an almost three-year-long hiatus when the future of the shuttle program was in doubt and many workers were laid off. Kennedy was one of a whole new crew of technicians hired to prepare the launch of the first shuttle sent back into space, Discovery.
Oh, it was beautiful. It was really neat. And when you're out there working, you're closer than just about anybody. When you're there and feel a launch, you feel the vibration and the rumble. The motors come through you, you know, as you're standing there.
Along Florida's Space Coast, from Titusville to Melbourne, there are former shuttle workers like Kennedy. And by the end of the month, there will be 2,000 more. Men and women with families, mortgages, and now the challenge of finding a new career. Kennedy says many of his former co-workers have already found jobs. He submitted applications with a number of companies, even some out of the area, so far without success.
I think part of the trouble I'm having right now is I might be overqualified for some of the jobs out here because they pay so much less. And I think the employers might be looking at it like, well, we could hire him for this less wages, but someone else comes along, makes him an offer, he's going to jump ship.
For old-timers here, there's a sense of deja vu. It was nearly 40 years ago when the Apollo program ended, and massive layoffs devastated this region's economy. This time, even though the overall economy is in much worse shape and Florida is still mired in a housing crisis, Lisa Rice says the impact will be far less. Rice is the president of Brevard Workforce, a jobs agency that serves the area. She says the area and its economy has grown greatly since those days. Another help is the $40 million the federal government has given the region to prepare for this day.
We've been in the planning and the training and the preparing stage for 4 years now, essentially. The workers are much better prepared. They've been getting their certifications. They've been getting work. So it's a different day.
Even with shuttle's demise, thousands of workers are still employed by dozens of aerospace companies working on defense and civil projects that continue to be launched at Cape Canaveral. More jobs will be added in coming years as private companies developing manned and unmanned vehicles are drawn to the Kennedy Space Center. But those jobs are still years away. In the meantime, many workers are hiring on with aviation companies that have been drawn to the area, such as Brazilian jet maker Embraer. There are also jobs in nearby Orlando. It's become a center of biotechnology and the computerized field of modeling and simulation, an emerging industry with applications from entertainment to manufacturing. In Rockledge, another company is taking the Space Coast in a different direction, designing and manufacturing a new type of car, the Rivian.
So here's another more built-up version of the platform.
RJ Scringe is the 28-year-old CEO of a startup car company. At the company's headquarters, he shows off what he calls Rivian's launch vehicle, a sleek sports car he expects to have on the road by the end of 2013.
As you can see, it's a 2+2 configuration, so a four-passenger vehicle set up with rear-wheel drive, mid-engine, so really truly a performance vehicle. Very aggressive looks in terms of the styling. We've tried to go for a look that really gets you excited looking at it.
Scringe says it was built not just for style and performance, but also with fuel efficiency in mind. This model gets more than 60 miles per gallon and will be priced, he says, in the mid-20s. Scringe grew up in this area. His father is an engineer whose company developed refrigeration units used on the space shuttle. He's planning not just to design, but also to manufacture his car here on the Space Coast. One reason, he says, is the available pool of experienced workers.
There's just a mountain of very talented, very capable technicians, engineers that we can tap into, particularly on the manufacturing side.
Eventually, Scringe says he may have more than 1,200 workers on site, plus those working for contractors and suppliers. It's the kind of emerging business that gives workers and officials on the Space Coast hope that the end of the shuttle may mark the beginning of a new, diversified economy. Greg Allen, NPR News.
As we heard earlier in the program, the debate over whether to raise the nation's debt ceiling has absorbed Washington lately, and President Obama will be holding a press conference on the issue later this morning. There are warnings that economic disaster could ensue if Congress fails to act. But as NPR's Jim Zaroli reports, the nation's financial markets seem to be taking the debate in stride.
It's not hard to find economists who think that it would be a big disaster for the U.S. economy if Congress doesn't raise the debt ceiling. All of a sudden, the government wouldn't have enough money to pay its debts, so it would have to stop writing checks for things like Social Security, or stop paying back the debt it owes, or maybe both. Beth Ann Bovino is an economist with Standard & Poor's.
I think that the government is playing with fire.
And yet, if the economy is approaching Armageddon, somebody forgot to tell the financial markets. Take Treasury bills. If investors were worried about a default, they would flee U.S. government debt and look for other places to put their money. John Canavan analyzes the credit markets at Stone and McCarthy.
A lot of money that would typically flow into treasuries in times of uncertainty would be more likely to flow into perhaps bunds in particular, that is German debt market.
And with less money flowing into treasuries, the government would have to pay higher interest rates to borrow what it needs. Mortgage rates would go up, and businesses would have to pay more to borrow. But nothing like that is happening yet. In fact, interest rates are still near historic lows. The yield on the 10-year treasury bill hovered near 3% on Friday. Why are investors being so blasé? John Canavan says they're simply focused on other things right now.
There has been some indication of a little bit of nervousness, but as far as the Treasury market is concerned, there have been more pressing near-term concerns.
Canavan says investors are concentrating on the slowing U.S. economy and the European debt crisis. As a result, Beth Ann Bovino says investors are looking for safe havens to put their money, and for all their problems right now, the U.S. Treasury markets still seem like the safest and most liquid in the world.
We're seeing weakness and certainly risk in the rest of the world, particularly in the Eurozone. So money is moving out of the rest of the world and into U.S. government debt.
The fact that money keeps flowing into U.S. government debt also suggests that many investors aren't yet taking the crisis seriously. Jim Paulson of Wells Capital Management is one of many people in the markets who think the current debt ceiling debate is little more than political theater. Members of Congress, he says, will almost certainly resolve the issue because the consequences of not doing so would be too terrible.
The reality is not a one of them is going to allow an effective and meaningful default of the U.S. government.
Paulson says far more important to investors right now are things like unemployment and retail sales data.
Those are what's going to drive these markets for the rest of the year, not this politically made-up drama.
And investors all over the world basically know this, he says. So with all of the other things going on in the economy, they still see the U.S. Treasury markets as safe. That could change as the deadline approaches, but for now, investors have other things on their minds. Jim Zaroli, NPR News, New York.
Next weekend, Carmageddon will hit Los Angeles. The city will close one of its main freeways, the 405, for 53 hours from Friday night to Monday morning. It's part of a billion-dollar project to widen the freeway that city planners hope will ease chronic congestion on the 405. But according to new research by an economist at the University of Toronto named Matthew Turner, that project, well, it will actually make traffic worse. Turner and a colleague studied traffic in 228 U.S. cities and determined that the more roads you build, the more congestion you create.
And what we found was that in cities where there was more roads, there was more driving. And in particular, if you had 1% more roads, you had 1% more driving in those cities.
One interesting thing I read in your study is about public transportation. Again, counterintuitive, you would think that the more public transportation that's built in a city, the more impact it would have on easing congestion. Here in Washington, D.C., as you probably know, we've got the Beltway around the city. It's notorious for traffic snarls. There's great public transit in this city. People have that option. But in fact, you say it doesn't always help either.
What we find is that as you increase a city's stock of light rail or bus cars, that there's no impact on the amount of driving, right? And that sounds sort of surprising, but it's logically consistent with the other result that we have about the effect of roads on driving. What we find is that as you add roads to a city, those roads get filled up, so there are people waiting to use that capacity. The result on transit is almost exactly the opposite of that.
So it's almost like there's a long line of people waiting to use that space on the freeway. The minute you put somebody in a bus or a metro train, someone else is just going to take their space on the roads.
I think that's right. I think there's a lot of people out there trying to decide whether to make one more trip to the store or drive a little further to work. And as you add a little bit more capacity, it gets filled up.
So now this is going to sound very frustrating to, you know, smart mayors all across America, because they're going to sort of listen to this and say, well, then what can I possibly do to ease congestion if I can't build more roads or I can't, build more public transit? What can I do?
We have really a small number of possible policy responses to congestion. One is capacity increases, one is transit increases, and the third is congestion pricing. And what we've shown is that the first two of those policy responses are unlikely to work, which leaves congestion pricing.
This is essentially charging people to drive into a city or to use a road, tolls.
That's exactly right, much in the same way as they do in London or Singapore or Stockholm.
In London, I think it costs about £10 to go into the city. And Mayor Bloomberg in New York actually had that idea, right? He wanted to charge a fee for people to drive into the city, but it was a non-starter.
And the reason it's a non-starter, I think, is that people don't want to pay for something that they're used to having for free, which is completely reasonable. However, we have enough experience with these programs now to know that, in fact, they really work. In response to pretty small fees, you see big reductions in travel time. So in Stockholm, the tolls to get into the city on the order of a couple dollars, and they saw 50% reductions in travel time at peak.
If you had a congestion charge to get into a city, wouldn't it naturally have a greater impact on people who might not necessarily be able to afford paying that charge?
I think the answer to that is yes, and that a concern with congestion charges is that they fall more heavily on the poor, for whom travel is a bigger share of their budget and who tend to have less discretion about when they go to work. I think the way you want to think about this is that road infrastructure and transportation infrastructure is fantastically expensive to build. And what we want to do is we want to organize the way we use these assets so that we use them to their best advantage. Right? And that may mean that some people move to different cities. It may mean that some people change the time when they go to work. We can't anticipate all the different margins of adjustment. Some of them will be painful for people and some of them will not be.
That's Matthew Turner. He's a professor of economics at the University of Toronto and a visiting fellow at the Property and Environment Research Center in Bozeman, Montana. Matthew Turner, thank you.
Thank you very much for having me on your show.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris. Officially, the recession ended 2 years ago, but that's not reflected in the jobs numbers.
Our economy as a whole just isn't producing nearly enough jobs for everybody who's looking.
President Obama spoke at the White House this morning after the release of the latest jobs report. It found the unemployment rate went up, not down. It's now 9.2%. And the thing economists watch most closely, the payroll number, came in much weaker than expected. NPR's Tamara Keith explores why job growth is so stagnant.
Every month, there's this exercise where economists and pundits predict the top-line job creation number in the Labor Department's report. This month, almost everyone said they thought payrolls would grow by 100,000 jobs or more. Then, at 8:30 a.m., the number came out. It was low, just 18,000.
Oh, God, I don't believe it. It was pretty much what I thought.
It was like getting a kick in the stomach. I mean, to see almost no jobs created in the month of June was just devastating.
That was Ian Shepherdson of High Frequency Economics and Diane Swonk, chief economist at Mesirow Financial. And their reactions were pretty typical. There's a common refrain in economics: one month does not a trend make. But May's jobs report was also weak. So that's 2 months. Is that a trend?
That's a slowdown. Now you've got to ask yourself, why would that happen?
Shepherdson thinks he knows exactly what happened, and he says everyone should calm down and take a deep breath.
What happened in the spring? Well, oil prices went up. I mean, that's it. It's as simple as that. Oil prices went up. I don't know why people are looking for these more complicated explanations or these end-of-the-world explanations when the real story is staring them in the face every time they go and fill the tank up.
After spiking in the spring, oil prices are back down below $100 a barrel now. There were probably also some residual effects from the Japanese tsunami and the tornadoes in the Midwest. Still, Diane Swonk says two tepid months of job creation are a real setback.
The recovery is still extremely fragile. We're still on an uphill battle, and it's going to be that way for some time to come.
Dig a little deeper into the report, and the picture doesn't get any prettier. Long-term unemployment remains near record highs. A broader measure of unemployment hit 16.2%. That measure includes people who want to work but have given up the search, and those working part-time who want full-time jobs. The average work week and average hourly wage both fell slightly last month. But it doesn't take a government report for many in the workforce to know things aren't what they used to be. Ray Meyer of St. Louis, Missouri, had been unemployed for more than 2 years when he started working temp jobs back in March.
I just am finding that these temporary jobs that I'm working on tend to treat their temporary employees differently, and I guess because we're disposable.
He used to be a regional manager for a bank. Now he's making about $15 an hour with no benefits and no job security.
If my conviction was strong before to get a permanent job someplace, my conviction now is even more strong if possible.
And Meyer has a job. Millions of others still don't. Diane Swonk of Mesereau Financial says we can expect this recovery to be slower and more painful than those in the recent past because it came out of a financial crisis that's crippled the housing industry. She's still optimistic about the economy long term, but less so than before these 2 months of stagnant job growth.
Even as we return to more robust job growth, frankly, the hurdles are so low. What's robust job growth at this stage of the game? It's not enough to make most Americans feel good about this economy.
June was the third month in a row that the unemployment rate rose. Tamara Keith, NPR News, Washington.